listeners, and welcome to another episode of the Day Recruit podcast. Today's episode is extracted from a conversation between artists Gail Berman and Ricky Burnett. The conversation is related to her solo exhibition titled Tomorrow on show at 142 Jan Smuts Avenue, Parkwood, Johannesburg. Visit the link in the description to find out more about the exhibition. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Well, good morning, everybody. Welcome especially to the people that have joined us at David Crutt. My name's Ricky Burnett, and I'm a painter in a similar vein to Gail. We're often been mistaken for each other, or certain phases of my painting career have been mistaken for looking like Gail's persistent look. One of the most remarkable things about Gail, I've known Gail for 50 years now, and she has stuck to her guns with enormous commitment, resolute commitment. I'm going to take a slightly oblique view in this conversation. I personally am frequently troubled by the kind of conversations we have about painting, the tendency to objectify and reify the experience, to think in terms of objectness rather than in terms of subjectivity. So often someone will say, well, what is it? What does it mean? I would prefer to answer the question, well, who is it? What are its intentions? In other words, begin to read into the image the living consciousness of the painter or the experience of that. And what is the experience that has been had that finds itself now embedded in the material? And it's one of the most extraordinary things about painting is that it depends for its success on a very deep superstition that is also deeply embedded in our evolution. How does inert matter come to resemble or participate in or exemplify consciousness? The fact of human presence is able to transmit itself into stuff, and stuff holds it there. Now, of course, our intelligence, our sense of ourselves, has in fact evolved out of inert geological matter over a long period of time. But that's what's happened. It's something fundamental to being human that we have this intimate involvement with stuff, and that stuff can sometimes, not always, but sometimes embody what it is like to be. There's a famous paper written in the 70s by philosopher Thomas Nagel, who sets the tone for consciousness studies of the 20th century with a title called What's It Like to Be a Bat? What's It Like to Be? Is the most fundamental question when dealing with the nature of consciousness. And indeed, one can look around the room and wonder, what's it like to be that painting? Now, I know that sounds crazy, but it's a lot better to me as a question than, for example, what is its contribution to gender studies, to identity crises, to inequality, injustice, and the failure of capitalism to deal with whatever it's supposed to deal with. There's a tremendous hubris embedded in that kind of thinking, which Gail doesn't share. Gail has a kind of modesty, but also an enormous sense of ambition relative to the philosophical questions that we're going to touch on. Now, in wanting to talk about subjectivity, I'm going to take two issues from Gail's artist statement. One has to do with her interest in Tang poetry, Tang Dynasty poetry. And the other has to do with a sort of slightly throwaway phrase, in my studio is where I feel most spiritual. But before I take that oblique view and start with talking about Tang Dynasty poetry. I want to introduce you to the Tang. It's sort of an accident of language, I suppose, from the Tang Dynasty to the Tang. Now, the Tang arrived nearly 50 years ago, as I remember it, and I happened to say, sort of off the cuff the other evening at the opening, that Gail's been drawing her tongue ever since. There's something that becomes very evident in that very first
self-portrait.
But it's a silent self-portrait, and it's got a sort of fuck you attitude. She's sticking her tongue out at herself, and she's looking at its surface, and she's looking at the sensitivity. You see, a tongue is a very sensitive surface. It's full of nerve ends and taste buds, but then so are these paintings. And I don't want to over-literalize that, but American poet Charles Wright once said, what lasts is what we start with. And for me, this Gail's tongue is an excellent way in to the 50 years of Gail's painting career. So that is my general introduction. And to move now to Tang poetry, we are going to turn this into a conversation, by the way. I'm very good at monologues, but I really will try not to hog it. I want to read you something written probably 700 in the middle part of the Tang Dynasty by a commentator who's not named in the source that I found. But the painting is by Zhi Huang. It's a painting and a poem. You see, one of the interesting things about Tang Dynasty poetry is it was painted as it was written. Now listen to this. Xi's calligraphy is like a brave warrior unsheathing his sword to dam the waters and stem their flow. A dot he placed at the top is like a rock falling down from a high precipice. A horizontal stroke he made is like a cloud sweeping across 1,000 miles. A slanting gnar stroke he dashed is like the roar of wind and thunder. A vertical stroke he wrote is like a 10,000-year-old withered vine, and tigers crouching across the phoenix's gateway like dragons leaping through heaven's door. Now, what is that? What's embedded in that, in all those ideas, those metaphors and attitudes? Is this, that the meaning is in the touch. The meaning is in the touch. What do you say about that? I mean, doesn't that exemplify something of this affinity you feel across the centuries with Tang poetry?
It does, and I found the Tang poetry by accident. Wendy Gu, you remember his extraordinary, at the 1997 second Biennale in Johannesburg, that Oki Emizor curated. You walked in and there was this curtain of hair. It was part of his United Nations project. He had taken hair from all over the world and weaved it. Which was the most extraordinary thing. Then I was at the Canberra Museum and walked into the basement without knowing there was work of his there. And he had made these stone scarabs, which were about 3,000 tons each. They were huge. And on it, he had taken the Tang poetry from the Jade Mountain, translated it back into Chinese and inscribed on each scale, which the rooms went from this wall almost across the road. And he had then inscribed each one. And that's how it came to the Tang poets. So from there, I looked for the book, The Jade Mountain. But reading them is completely inspirational, because the Tang Dynasty then was extremely wealthy because it had conquered everybody. It was the largest country in the world at that time, which was medieval. And out of it came all these poets who, if you worked in a council position, which is what people aspired to, you had to be able to write poetry, and that was part of it. But they had to move around because of wars, and so their poetry relates to emotions, to landscape, to longing, to love, death, and war, which I found was a wonderful inspiration. The paintings themselves do not relate to an entire poem. I will find a line and then work out in my head and relate it to landscape or inescape or outerscape. I don't think these paintings are abstract expressionism. I see them more as an abstract experience. And I will then consider the painting from the top to the bottom. I will start at the top and finish at the bottom. So there's not a case of, well, let me turn around, let me do this. You can meander along the way, but basically that's what they are.
And as I understand it, Tang poetry has a very formal, rigid structure to it, doesn't it?
It does.
And also, as I understand it, as I discovered this morning, there are two primary qualities, slant and level, in the movement of it, which again relates to the kind of field or surface that you work with.
Yeah, and the big paintings, which I love because your whole body is immersed in them. The smaller ones became a big challenge, and they grow out of the bigger ones. But the joy of painting, the absolute sensual, and the poems themselves are sensual.
You mentioned the body, and with your permission, I'm going to step into some dangerous territory here, because one of the things that's extraordinary for me, having known you as I have for 50 years, you've lived with pain for 50 years.
40, please, give me a chance. 44. One those age.
It all feels like 50 years. But what is actually quite fascinating is that the paintings themselves are never, you could never say that they were suffused with a cry, an agony, a sense of injustice, a sense of your physical presence in the painting is a confident, full-bodied experience. Right? And you've never felt the need to make art which is about complaint. Why not?
Firstly, I'm largely in denial.
In denial.
Secondly, I do enjoy life. I want to escape that. And I promise you, I rail to the gods when I'm alone. I do use my body in one way. I put my bandages on the paintings.
I think to the sort of average, partially educated eye, the tendency would be to walk into a room like this and think, influenced by abstract expressionism. What is interesting for me is that they are not actually expressionist paintings. And if they're not, but they are abstract paintings.
They are abstract.
But if they're not expressionist paintings, then what are they?
I call them an abstract experience because it's my experience.
Yeah.
And I love abstract expressionism, but I don't have to paint like that. And I love looking at it and the history behind it. But if you go back to my paintings in the 1990s, They were abstract but had large figurative images in them. And they were pretty dark, but so was I.
I mean, you've worked intensely with photography and as an archivist, and probably are one of the, if not the most, most extraordinary reservoirs of knowledge of South African photography. And just how deep is the cleavage between your interest in photography and your interest in painting? Or is there some undercurrent that I can't see that connects those two things?
There is no undercurrent. I have a passion for history and for archive. I can look at archive if I'm having lunch or something like that. I will go into an archive website. It's a thing of who are these people? What were they? The history that happened there that's getting lost. But there's no, they are completely separate points. Completely separate.
Right.
And looking at a photograph, I don't have the knowledge of how it was taken, but I've certainly got the eye.
Yeah.
And it's that thing, this is an instant in time, whereas footage is a much lengthier.
Yeah.
But that instant in time, and who are these people and what happened to them?
Yeah.
And even landscape photography has that same thing. It's just that beautiful instant. But there's certainly no correlation between the two. The things I did in the 90s, which had a lot of photographs collage, were because I used to do location finding. In those days, you went with a camera like this, you had no video. And that then came back onto my paintings. So there were a lot of photographs with plastered on them, which all led to the actual image that was there. But certainly there is a division between the two. And filmmakers I work with have no idea I'm also painting. Very few.
The two persistent ideas in Tang poetry that struck me in my brief flirtation with it. One is the idea of moonlight, which is associated with what I can only think of as intimate distance, and the fact that moonlight is reflected light rather than direct. And moonlight is not just a named theme, but a definite presence in your sense of colour. And the other is drunkenness. The Tang poets seem to drink an enormous amount. But you never do.
No, I don't. But so, Lee Poe was constantly drunk. Most of his poems were about moonlight, about people, and mostly about wine. Apparently, it's said, and I think it's a myth, when he died, he was in a boat on the Yangtze, and the moon was a bright full moon, and he tried to lean over to hug the reflection in the water, and he fell over and he drowned. I don't know if it's true, but that's what's said.
Can we now try this notion of spiritual?
I think I am and always have been far more spiritual than religious. And in my studio, I always paint listening to music. And in my studio, I definitely feel at the most complete, the most spiritual, the most enjoyment.
Okay.
There's something very sensuous about oil paint.
Yeah. Can you, without necessarily having to over-intellectualize it, explain or describe what does spiritual feel like to you? What are its qualities, the qualities you experience that you don't experience, for example, when standing in a queue at the grocery store?
Completeness.
Yeah.
Imagination.
Yeah.
enjoyment and a closeness, probably with oneself, and an honesty.
So you would tend to think then of the notion of being spiritual, having a spiritual experience, as being more present and less absent.
Yes.
Because a lot of people would think of spiritual as being kind of absence or transcendence. You're seeing it as being more grounded rather than floating. So does my phrase, intimate distance, make sense for you in terms of the both the poetry and the painting?
Definitely.
Okay. And given that your response is to fragments or lines rather than whole poems, there's a something that you want to grasp. Peter Handeker, a playwright, novelist in this particular instance, said in one of his books, he describes someone singing in a bar, and he says he didn't sing with feeling, but he searched frantically for a feeling which was as puzzling to him as to anyone else. The point I'm making here is that the feeling is known when it's found rather than before it's begun.
Yes.
Correct?
Correct.
Okay. So the intention is to find something previously not seen by you.
Probably. Although landscape...
I mean, despite the family resemblance between
the
activity.
The activity. So when you find a line, you start to think of something new. Which I'm sure if you read something, all of us will find something in it. And probably none of us will find the same thing. It's like people walking. If you have seven people walking past a room and looking in, each one will give you a different opinion of what they saw.
But now, to go back to the earlier remark I was making about the sense of presence or aliveness in the image, and it is absolutely possible to spend your life, I know this very well, playing with paint and finding that it very rarely, if ever, shows any signs of life. What are the signs of life in paint? How do you know? I mean, I think one of the fascinating things for anybody who's never painted is how do you move from one decision to the next? What is the sense that this is dead matter and this is living matter? Even, I mean, most animals, as far as I can tell, have an acute sense of when something is alive or when something's dead. Right? And we know that.
Yep.
And you know that. In your paint, you know when it's alive and when it's dead. But how is that information communicated to you?
I think the sensuality of paint, first of all. The sensuality of making a mark. I'm not sure it's always a conscious decision. The conscious decision is in the start. There are often parts you've got to paint over because you've killed it dead.
No.
Somebody asked me how you know when a painting's finished. And you know when you can go no further. And if you do go further, you kill it dead. So how does it happen? I think I've got to paint to music, I have to say. And not necessarily music that relates to any line. It's normally... Well, it is classical or opera. And you sort of sail away. You become immersed in both the paint and the music. So that the decisions are conscious when you start, but not all of them are conscious as you go along. You've then got to stop step away, and you've got to work on at least 7 paintings at a time, simply because of the oil, and the length it takes to dry. Does that answer you?
Probably not, but I don't think there is an answer.
I think
it's a trick and dirty question.
Very, very dirty question.
But it's something we spend our lives engaged with, never being able to formulate the answer. There's a nice quote in a book by Clarice Lispector. She says, the character in the book says, "How curious that I'm unable to say who I am. The moment I try to speak, not only do I fail to express what I feel, but what I feel slowly transforms itself into what I'm saying."
There you go.
Here's the thing, then, this notion of subjectivity and presence. I make the case for a good painting being an opportunity for a very rare intimacy.
Yeah.
In other words, what you put here is a special bit of Gaelness, which is the same thing as a special kind of humanness, and I get to participate in that. Correct?
You do, and I hope you get to participate in it as well from your view, but not mine. I hope they give a different experience.
But that's why I make to lose the word expressionist and replace it with experience makes some sense, as awkward as the phrase may be.
Yeah. I have to tell you, after all these years, still intimidated by a white canvas. So they always get a wash behind. The wash starts with the idea that I fall on the painting before I start. Well, I always consider Ricky to be highly intellectual. And I always think his paintings come from an intellectual point. Am I right?
I'll accept the compliment.
My work is more emotional. And the playfulness does come from the enjoyment. And because I don't want to think of other things when I'm painting. I often do, and they will come into it. But there is this total sense, the sensuousness of oil does that as well. They're much looser.
No, I don't like to think of myself as unplayful or unemotional.
No, you've got emotion.
I'd probably save my emotions for more social situations than paint. I think one of the differences between Gail and I is that Gail has, she staked her claim very early on with the tongue and has doggedly stuck with it. I try different things. I think there are some people in this room who've always looked like themselves. William, for example. I've known William for as long as I've known Gail, and William has always looked like William, never had any doubts about it. Whereas I don't know what I look like. That's the earnestness, is the sense of sort of
a quest,
a deep uncertainty that if at some point. I might feel that, that's the person I've been looking for, but he keeps escaping me. There's a little line here from Zhang Chao.
Yes.
He said, "My painting is a reaching outward to intimate creation and a turning inward to master the mind." And I thought that was quite a nice observation relative to what we were talking about earlier, which is the absence of pain the absence of complaint in your painting, that there is a mastery of mind going on, and there is, and a reaching outward to intimacy, to which is, again is a, is, it sort of rhymes rather nicely with this interest in moonlight. I have a poem that I want to read you by Paul Verlaine, who it's called Clair de Lune, and it inspired Debussy's piece of music called Clair de Lune. The last stanza in particular, I'd like you to take careful notice of. He wrote, "Your soul is a chosen landscape where charming masquerades and dancers are promenading, playing the lute and dancing, and almost sad beneath their fantastic disguises. While singing in a minor key of victorious love and the pleasant life, they seem not to believe in their own happiness, and their song blends with the light of the moon, with the sad and beautiful light of the moon, which sets the birds in the trees dreaming and makes the fountains sob with ecstasy, the slender water streams amongst the marble statues." And given my preface earlier about subjectivity, presence, personhood, and the transformation of matter into experience, it seemed to me that rather than take questions, I would rather ask a question of you, which is to sit here a bit longer and see if you can set your birds dreaming in Gale's moonlit trees. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.